Well, Werner has covered the territory and said many things that I would have said. So I'll emphasize some other things. And if you could just take a couple and then stop. Because whenever that goes, I just keep looking around. I want to emphasize the fluidity of this project. We had a wonderful board of 10 people who joined in, who took part in two-day early morning till late in the evening marathons without the slightest hint of testiness, of turf defense, of I know more about this than you do. That was always absent. I think everybody who took part in this project was stunned by how much they didn't know about what happened in the last 500 years in this expanse of territory. And so people were always open. You know, when the suggestion came up, and this really was not meant as a provocation, from Gerald Early, who was the most, who would have been the chief contributor to this book. I think there were 8 or 9 essays that Gerald wanted to write, including quite a few that he was responsible for assigning to other writers. And it got to the point where he said, look, I really need to write this. I'll do it under another name. No one will know. And he did write about Tarzan, and he did write about, oh, so many things. The Tarzan essay is my favorite. Mm-hmm. But things were made up as we went along. We did have this heroic meeting where we cut everything down to 220 essays. I think it was maybe 240, and we said, oh, we'll lose them by attrition, as if here is an essay that's absolutely crucial. We have argued, we have discussed, we realize it must be in this book, and we say, oh, well, we'll lose it by attrition. That was never going to happen. But then there came the point where Gerald said, well, what about Linda Lovelace? And everybody turned to him, and he wasn't kidding. And we said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, this is a cultural turning point. Everything changed after this, and our culture was never the same. And he made this argument, and okay, we began to think about it, and he convinced us. And the basic argument was this. Look, here is someone who's written 4 autobiographies with different as-told-tos and co-writers and so on. 4 autobiographies. 2 were all about, God, I was a libertine. I did everything. And 2 were, I was a slave. I was forced to do everything. She wrote, she did not invent, but she mined the confessional genre in a way that nobody else did. She both exposed everything she had to expose and hid within that genre, as writers always do. This is the dominant form of literature in this country over the last 30 or 40 years. Who better to do this? So we thought about who could write about this? Who's the right person for this? Anne Marlowe. Anne Marlowe is a New York writer who wrote a book about heroin. She wrote a book about a love affair. She now covers Afghanistan for the Weekly Standard and the Wall Street Journal. She's a very conservative writer politically and a very unconservative writer in every other way. So it was kind of like when I tried to find someone to do the Absalom, Absalom, Gone with the Wind entry. And I contacted Lee Smith, who's a great Southern novelist, born in Virginia, now lives in Chapel Hill, has written, I think, 12 novels. My favorite is called The Devil's Dream. And this is a woman in her 60s, I mean, a white woman in her 60s, a deep Southerner. Well, I've never read Gone with the Wind. I've seen the movie. I didn't believe it, but she promised she had never read Gone with the Wind. And, you know, you can't really say, okay, well, I'd really like you to take this on. It's only 800 pages or whatever it is. Then I called Bobby Ann Mason, another Southern writer from Kentucky, about the same age. Well, I've never read Gone with the Wind. I've seen the movie. And I just didn't believe it. So I called Ann Marlowe and said, Ann, how would you, you know, like to write about Linda Lovelace? And she said, well, I've never seen Deep Throat. And it was kind of like, you've never seen Deep Throat? And, you know, here we all this cultural literacy with people that, you know, we thought would be right. So she got a copy online. She got what seemed to be a 10th generation dub. She said it was very, very bad. It was hard to watch. And Gerald said, well, I would have loaned her my copy. But she dove into those four books, and she excavated those four books, and she lived in those four books. There did come a point during our brainstorm meeting when, as Werner said, oh, the electric chair, and, you know, what about the Pez dispenser? And I don't think that really came up, but it was going in that direction. When David Thompson, who was one of the editorial board members, one of the few who was not an academic. David is a great film critic and film historian. He's also a novelist, a social historian. And he just almost pounded the table without exactly using his fist, and he said, this book has got to get a lot more conventional before it gets crazy. And we turned around, and we turned back to Emerson, and we turned back to Hemingway, and we turned back to Jefferson. Not that any of these people weren't there, but we really began to see, you know, there need to be anchors before you cut the anchor. And so we ended up with two entries on Emerson, on the American Scholar and the Divinity School Address. And, you know, the easiest thing in the world would have been to find experts on Emerson and have them give us a cool, plain, simple account of how these addresses are touchstones in American culture. And that's exactly what we didn't want and exactly what we didn't get. We got someone who read these addresses as if for the first time and said, what's going on here? What's happening? Why is this being said now? What does it sound like today? And I remember reading those entries and feeling as if I knew I had never even encountered the subjects of those essays before. And that happened again and again. But some of this book was made up as it went along. And that's why, if it's a success, if it is something you can read for pleasure, if you are engaged by the engagement of the writers themselves, that's why. The most frightening piece for me came in. It was by Robert O'Mealy, who's a professor at Columbia. And he was writing the entry on Billie Holiday. And I got the thing, and I looked at it, and I looked at the pages, and then I counted the pages to see if it was really what it looked like. Because these pieces were supposed to be 2,500 words at the most, and this was clearly over 6,000 words. And the only one way to cut a 6,000-word essay down to 2,500 words, and that's with a meat cleaver. You don't go looking for a sentence that, you know, maybe you can do without. And so, And that kind of thing is really very easy to cut. So I cut it down to, I think, 2,100 words. It was a very shapely essay then. But what was left out was a passionate cry about Gail Jones, an African-American novelist who in the mid-70s wrote two books, Corregidora and Eva's Man, which got some attention. And then she pretty much disappeared. She wrote a couple of other novels years later. Her personal life blew up in many bombs, and she withdrew. She disappeared. People thought she was dead. And she has still disappeared. And what was left out was a lost essay on her first novel, Corregidora. And clearly, this is the kind of person who could get her due in this book. And some people have already said, Gail Jones? Who knows about Gail Jones? Who cares about Gail Jones? What about John Updike? What about Don DeLillo? Well, what about them? This is somebody who we put our money on. We put our bet on. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. With Kara Walker, she said at one point, I'm too busy. I can't possibly do this. She didn't mention what people were being paid. At one point, she did say she wanted to make it clear that Harvard would not own the originals of the artwork that she supplied. I don't know why that came up, because everything simply came over on a computer and we printed it out. There were no originals in that sense at all. And she said something like, because, you know, I'd feel really bad if Harvard owned the originals and then they turned around and sold them for $250,000. And I said, oh, really? That's interesting. She didn't mention what she was being paid, which was really kind of that amount reduced by many, many zeros. And her attitude was, I can't possibly say no to this. You know, you're asking me to have the last word in the history of the country? Who could say no to that? And that's pretty much how people reacted, one after the other. People who we invited to contribute to this book trusted this project more than we did. So that's the, you know, this can really get close to tooting our own horn. I really don't want to do that. But I'll just say one more thing. We have had a lot of difficulty explaining why this is called A New Literary History of America. What does that mean? And we've come up with a lot of really good or not so good explanations. But the best came in one of the early reviews of the book and said, this is a literary history, stressing the literary. And I thought, right, it's written. It's thought through. Every one of these essays is somebody confronting the language of their subject and trying to find the language that will open it up. In every case, this is a matter of people attempting to talk to their subject matter and make their subject matter talk to them. It is literary in the best, most alive, and least pretentious sense, if we've succeeded. If we haven't, we won't have to explain what it's about. Thank you.